Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the OIS China Programme. I'm Michal Maidan, Head of China Research at the Institute, and I'm joined today by Ned Downey, who is a PhD student at the Princeton School of International Affairs, but also a co-author of the Guide to Chinese Climate Policy that we published last year. Now, we're here today to talk about China's Belt and Road Initiative. Started off, I think, being called One Belt, One Road in English. In Chinese, it's been consistently Yi Dai Yi Lu. But it is 10 years to the BRI, and this is sort of a really signature foreign policy project that was announced by Xi Jinping in October 2013 in Kazakhstan. The project sort of harks back to the Silk Road, but really its geographic scope has been much broader than the traditional Silk Roads. And it's very much a sprawling vision for interconnection between China and essentially the rest of the world. Infrastructure investments have been a core component of the vision. We have seen a lot of ink spilled on the Belt and Road, but also more practically, lots of funding and Chinese banks and companies committing to projects and contracting deals across the Belt and Road. Although, to be fair, there was a lot happening before that sort of formal designation. What we wanted to do today was to really take a look back at those 10 years, but also look forward at the Belt and Road. And Ned is extremely well placed to discuss this with us. He wrote a very comprehensive chapter on this in the Guide to Chinese Climate Policy. So we thought it would be nice to catch up today and sort of take a look back and, as I say, also a look forward. So Ned, welcome back to the OIS podcast.
Thanks for having me, Michal. Great to be here.
Let's start with the context and more specifically the Belt and Road and the energy and mining components in particular.
You've given a pretty good overview already of kind of what the Belt and Road is. The way I think about it is from two different perspectives, a top-down and a bottom-up one. So top-down, it's a political framework for Chinese outbound diplomacy focused on interconnection. It started off Europe and Asia, and now really the whole world. But bottom-up, it's a repackaging in a lot of ways of ongoing initiatives or ongoing efforts around trade and investment since the 2000s, that of China. It's become a vessel for a lot of different actors' interests. And an important set of actors within that are in the energy sector and in the mining sector as well. Energy is, you know, a natural part of kind of that broader connectivity vision because infrastructure plays a really central role in that, in connectivity. And the Belt and Road is broadly conceived, but infrastructure is probably the most prominent piece, reflecting both the history of Chinese investment outbound, which has had a strong infrastructure bent and a strong natural resources bent from well before the Belt and Road was announced in 2013, as well as China's own deep pool of firms and mechanisms for infrastructure built out within its own borders that the Belt and Road is given an opportunity to take abroad. So to give a sense of the role of energy and metals, 60% of recorded investment and contracting deals by value under the belt since 2005 through mid-2021, 60% of those were the energy, metals, or transport. And energy was the largest chunk. Energy is about a third of all Chinese outbound investment from mid-2005 to July 2021 or so, at least from the databases that we have. So that looks very different from a lot of other Western and multilateral overseas development investment, things like that, where that tends to focus more on public administration or discretionary spending. And is one of the, so that's one of the signature aspects of China's outbound footprint in that regard.
And it's interesting, you talk about the bottom-up and the top-down aspects of it, and then, you know, the databases that we've seen. Energy has loomed large. I guess, can you talk us through, I guess, the methodology of this, right? The BRI is vast in its geographic scope. In the definitions that China has of overseas direct investment or aid, how do we think about the bureaucracy of the BRI, maybe the challenges in assessing the activities, the impact within this huge cosmos, right, of Chinese outbound investments and energy? And there was a lot of talk about the BRI as a vessel for China to try and absorb energy or sort of to change energy flows towards it, right, to get Central Asian energy into China. How do we make a bit of sense of all this? Again, the top down, the bottom up, and some of those dynamics.
I think, how do you measure that scope of impact? What is, so we know the BRI is a big picture, but kind of granularly, how do we understand its progress and the ways in which it's transforming are affecting global trade flows, global investment flows. A couple different perspectives you can take on this. One is you can think of it as a diplomatic initiative. Right? And there you look at what are the countries that are participating, so to speak. And the main metric of participation, the Chinese side tracks, this is a very reasonable approach, is the MOUs around the Belt and Road Initiative. So bilateral MOUs as well as MOUs with international organizations. So as of June 2023, you had 152 countries and 32 international organizations that had signed memorandums of understanding, MOUs, with China on the Belt and Road. That's spread across Africa, Asia, Central and Eastern Europe, Oceania, a little bit less penetration, obviously US and Western Europe, Latin America, as well as some of the middle powers like Brazil, India, Australia. So that's kind of one way to think about the geographic scope of what's going on and how we measure that. As a connectivity driver as well, want to look at what are the actual investment flows that are associated with the Belt and Road. One of the challenges there, of course, is that there's not an official list of BRI projects. This is one of the things that makes it this kind of development or this bottom-up initiative. So in a lot of ways, we end up relying upon third-party data sets that are tracking large outbound contracting and investment projects within all over the world. And, you know, as I just kind of said here, the geographic scope, it's not everybody, but it's a lot. So if you're tracking the world, you're tracking the BRI as well. And in the book, we have a pretty long list of some of those granular investment and contract, or those granular databases, which have been really valuable. You know, certainly there's some official reporting on impacts. There was a white paper that the State Council, that is China's executive body, just put out last week or so, talking about 21 free trade agreements since the Belt and Road initiation and 144 air transport bilateral deals. So if you're looking for a very specific angle on it, you might be able to find some information there. Lastly, we can think about the Belt and Road as an institution and an institution that's managed by a bureaucracy. And so, you know, as a bottom-up project, it's quite diffuse in terms of the array of different players that are involved. But if you want to be following the Belt and Road, the most important group to be following is the leading group for promoting the Belt and Road. Leading groups are coordinating, informal interministerial coordinating groups within the Chinese political system. And it's a signature of the Belt and Road's significance that it's housed within China's most, the secretariat for this leading group is housed within China's most important, most powerful single agency, the National Development Reform Commission, and it's chaired by a Politburo member.
Interesting. And you talked about, it's funny and always interesting to me how on one hand we get a lot of data, right? Numbers about FTAs and agreements and number of announcements, a number of countries, but not so much on the specifics. What do those MOUs actually mean? Which of the projects do get built and what happens on the ground within all that? And obviously there are databases that you've looked at. What have been to you some of the striking and most interesting trends, perhaps in terms of the sectors or the geographies and any notable evolution that you've seen over time?
Yeah, I think I'll share two big picture trends, one that's a high level trend and one that's a sectoral trend, at least for this audience here. So high level, look at those outbound investment and contracting activity flows. You see something of a surge in the mid-2010s. So again, to step back, the BRI repackages a lot of outbound investment and trade efforts that have been made by many actors across the Chinese party state and economy since the 2000s. And so, you know, there's plenty happening already before 2013. You see a bit of a surge in the mid-2010s in the databases that we track in that outbound investment and contracting. But then you see a major retrenchment since then. I think that's really the most important story in the Belt and Road over the past 5 years or so is an attempt to switch away from volume towards quality. And so that means on the latter front, that means more targeted, lower volume of investments. And the goal is to have investments that, you know, are going to be a better position to drive returns as well as that taken more into account sustainability considerations. And these are pretty closely related. I think as we can talk a little bit more when we talk about the energy sector later on. And an in-sector level, let's focus on energy here, rightfully so, because it's the most important component of those BRI outbound flows. But you've seen changes in the types of investment that Chinese firms and contracting the Chinese firms are doing outbound over the past, from the pre-BRI era through that sort of surge in BRI to today. So pre-BRI era is really oil is taking the lead. Oil investment was around half of outbound investment in databases that we've tracked from 2005 to around 2013 when the BRI was announced. in that mid-2010s period, you see a shift in that composition. It's going more towards fossil power. Oil is still a significant part of it, but not as prominent. And when we say fossil power here, we're really saying mostly coal. So more than half in most studies of Chinese outbound energy investment on a sort of gigawatt basis went into coal. And that's over the past 15, 20 years. That's not a new trend necessarily. 12% of the global coal fleet outside of China has had some sort of Chinese financial or contracting participation. The other segments that you see, or the other generation types that you see, are really most of the low carbon stuff has been in hydropower. Over the past couple of years, we're seeing a shift away from coal and towards more renewables, so more low carbon forms of energy. That was confirmed by Xi Jinping's announcement in September 2021 that China would build no new coal, and we can come back to this later. But that's been an ongoing trend as part of this retrenchment. A lot of coal plan projects that did not actually get completed. Going forward, already we're seeing greater interest in what investment activity still does happen with the energy sector. A greater share of that is going towards greener sources.
In the 2010s, sort of mid-2010 surge and drop in oil outbound investment, that obviously coincides with the big purges and the anti-corruption push in the oil and gas sector. 2010s was the peak outbound investments in oil, and after that, they pretty much fell off a cliff, and that coincides with that. Interestingly, when you talk about volume towards quality, sort of that retrenchment, what do you think were the main drivers of that?
I think in a lot of ways it was seeing how hard it is to do outbound investments well. Sort of say that this is a cycle that we've seen in other countries in their outbound investment profile as well. You saw this in the Japanese case as well. A lot of companies in the first wave of outbound investment, as a country is taking its own economic wealth and trying to find ways to take advantage of opportunities outside of its borders, are quite enthusiastic about outbound markets. And then once you get into them, you realize just how hard it is to do it well. That's particularly the case in a lot of the geographies that China focused on in the global south. Geographies where, you know, to give an example, in the metals and mining sector, I mean, I remember speaking to a Chinese mining participant in the mining sector within China back in 2017-18, and he basically said, look, you know, one of the great challenges we face is that all the good resources have already been gotten by Western actors. Right? We're left with the dregs. And so when you're left with the dregs, the financial position of those in terms of being able to recover your investments are more challenging. And I think in a lot of ways, that's a dynamic that's been repeated across a number of sectors in, you know, energy. You've got 60% of investment flows and contracting flows going to energy, transport, and metals. These are highly capital intensive sectors and sectors where you can really lose money. And so I think that those financial strains are ones that prompted that retrenchment.
You know, we think about, or often in the West, there's this perception of China as the great monolith that directs outbound investments and has mega plans for the BRI. So what you describe in mining was essentially what the oil majors went through in the early 2000s, right? They had to pick up the scraps that the IOCs left, and they went to very risky countries, and sometimes they suffered very significant consequences, financial, operational, and others. And I remember speaking to some of those executives when the BRI started, and they would say, other sectors are making all the same mistakes that we did. We don't have, and sort of lamenting the lack of institutional capacity to pass on those lessons to other sectors. And they were saying they're just making the exact same mistakes. And, you know, we can't even warn them or help transmit this knowledge that we have gained with our experience.
Yeah, I mean, I've also done some work separately on Chinese outbound investment in agriculture, particularly focusing on northern Myanmar. And this is at a much smaller scale, but this is in small level, you know, mostly private enterprises coming out of the borderlands between China and Myanmar on the Yunnan side, that is in southwest China. A lot of players who were excited and enthusiastic about opportunities for investing in northern Myanmar and then really got caught up in conflict. So you see that exact same trend happening at different levels, you know, in the big industries, basically, in the capital intensive ones, and also in these small scale players. It's an economy-wide process.
The genesis of sort of risk management. I want to go back to one point you said, and I hope I heard correctly. You said that 12% of the global coal fleet has Chinese financing in it, which when we think about China as obviously a global leader in coal, right, the biggest producer, consumer domestically, but there is also this impression that China is the biggest financier, at least that was my impression of coal overseas. This 12% actually sounds quite small. So who else is investing in coal? And how does China's activity compare to other countries? You were talking a little bit about the learning curve and how Japan and other countries have followed this outbound investment learning curve. But can you tell us a bit about, again, how we compare it and think about it and contextualize it with other countries?
What is often lost in the discussions of China's global presence as a financier is a key adjective, which is the largest public financier of X, rather than the largest single financier. You know, in the infrastructure sector, right, China's definitely the largest infrastructure financier in the developing world among public financial institutions and multilateral development banks. But there's a lot of money in the private sector. You know, in some of these sub areas, that's often what is dominating the actual capital flows. So to give in coal, as I mentioned, largest overseas financier in the 2010s, no question about that. So that 12% reflects in part, you know, projects that were developed before the 2010s and before the kind of the period of Chinese growing outbound investment, 2000s and 2010s. You got some range of projects that are just, you know, kind of emerging before then. But also just even in the 2010s itself, more than 80% of coal that was added or under planning outside of China from 2013 to mid-2019 had no Chinese financial participation. That's a Boston University study. The financial participation there is large private capital, so Western and Japanese financial institutions in particular. So in the mining sector, this is somewhat more stark in a certain way because China is generally more of a processor than an extractor. So I think there's a lot of discussion today about China's role in global supply chains around critical minerals for the energy transition. And that is absolutely an enormous one, but it's important to, analytically, it's just important to recognize that China's role is not necessarily as the owner across the value chain. It's actually at the most useful part of the value chain to control, which is the processing side of it. And often the actual raw materials are ones that are sourced some from Chinese companies, but often from international mining companies, you know, suppliers like the major, you know, Anglo-American, Rio Tinto, BHP, these kind of global giants that are headquartered out of the West. That trend is changing in some sort of niche minerals. In lithium, for instance, Chinese companies has put $4.5 billion into stakes in almost 20 mines over the last 2 years and is pushing for a share of up to about a third of global capacity or global output. Can't remember the number exactly, by 2025. So, but, you know, $4.5 billion, sure, for lithium, that's a lot, but this is a niche sector. Let's remind that it's an important sector, but in terms of the overall capital flows, it's a niche one. If you look across different kinds of metals and mining, you'll see that as of 2020, Chinese companies controlled less than 20% of global mineral production, and just 3.5% of global mineral production was under Chinese companies in mines outside of China. Again, China is a processor, the dominant position or very large position in processing a lot of metals, but it buys stuff from other countries or from other suppliers.
Absolutely. And that's sort of another area that at the Institute, we have been working a lot on the critical minerals and on China's role in both the upstream and the processing. And that's a very important, I think, characterization and important to bear in mind. But all this investments, be they in coal, in mining, in metals, even though they are useful and will be needed for the energy transition, that has a carbon footprint. What do we know about the emissions and the carbon footprint of the BRI?
Very good question. It's a challenging one to analyze because of just that breadth and diversity of activities. You know, if you wanted to do scope three, that is full, or if you want to do full life cycle analyses of all of these different activities, it's at a minimum very data intensive role. And that starts with collecting all the data associated with what's going on in the BRI. But maybe the easiest stuff to measure is the direct emissions from energy generating plants, right? So these coal investments. In terms of coal plants developed with Chinese participation, either financing and or contracting over the past 20 years, estimates are putting about 250 to 500 million tons of CO2 equivalent per year with an assumption of a 40-year lifetime. So that's probably anywhere you'll see figures from 10 to 18 gigatons or so over a 40-year lifetime. So to give a sense of perspective, the annual emissions there are probably about 1% to 2% of global emissions. So on the one hand, a small share of global emissions. On the other hand, a lot of global emissions, if you think about just like this is just this one niche of, you know, coal plants developed with Chinese financing. It's important to put that in a comparative perspective, though. Those figures are pretty comparable on a lifetime perspective with Japanese public funding. It's much larger than the U.S., which is mostly in gas. on a plant level basis, the Chinese tend to invest in more efficient coal plants, though more efficient coal plants don't, they only move the needle so much in terms of overall emissions footprint. Coal is still coal. There are a lot of other indirect channels, obviously, as I've hinted at. So deforestation, say, and changes in land use associated with projects or changes in economic activity, those ones are a bit harder to measure. So there's definitely a lot of importance in that greening the BRI work for controlling those. Getting a data-driven perspective on that is challenging, but at a high level, it's pretty clear where the direction of travel we hope can go.
You also alluded earlier, you said earlier that Xi Jinping has announced no new coal-fired plants overseas. You talked about the greening of the Belt and Road. Can you tell us more about that and some of the trends that you're seeing? Where is that going?
The idea of greening of the Belt and Road is a really important piece of this shift from volume to quality. And as one whose impact, we're still seeing how that's going to unfold. So on the coal perspective, Xi in 2021, he said specifically that China is going to stop building new coal-fired projects abroad and will prudently proceed with the existing ones under construction. And that latter matter is really the big question to understand how much of an impact this pledge has. So for new projects, I think as I alluded to already, the financial picture in general of outbound coal investments out of China was the viability of those investments. There's a lot of reasons to think that that was an increasingly unappealing sector to go into before Xi made that announcement. Between 2014 and 2020, you had 52 coal projects with Chinese financial participation outside of China. One of those had gone in operation as the end of 2020. One of those 52 had gone in operation as the end of 2020. Half of them had been shelved, eight of them had been canceled, other ones were in various stages of the pipeline. But this coal was clearly, and even of the ones that had been under construction as of 2014 in that period, only half of them had actually completed and gone into operation. Coal does not normally take 6 years to build, right? So if you got half of those projects, though, had not actually gone into operation as of the end of 2020. And this just reflects the fundamental change in context for doing coal investment. Now, solar, a lot cheaper, wind, increasingly, again, down the cost curve. The economic position for coal compared to other energy sources had weakened. This compounds with the environmental impacts of coal-fired power plants, which would often prompt local resistance around them. And so the appetite within countries for adding coal power was something that was waning. And so I think in a lot of ways, the no new coal project pledge out of China, out of Xi Jinping there, was a reflection of that changing reality. Because again, you know, the Belt and Road is not in, as this bottom-up vessel, it's one where Chinese companies looking to do projects and host countries that are looking to have projects from Chinese players. And the host countries have a very important role in shaping what the actual projects that emerge under this framework look like. But let's go back again, right? We have, so nothing new is happening necessarily, and that's still the case. No new investments that you've seen in any of the databases that track these things. The question is, what's going to happen to the products that were under construction or in some sort of pre-construction pipeline? So the best update from this has been, the best tracking on this has been out of the Center on for Research on Energy and Clean Air out of Finland. And their last update from a year out from that pledge, so last September or so, you know, indicated that there was still a lot of uncertainty, basically, about what was going to happen to that existing pipeline. So about 100 gigawatts in that pipeline in total, to give a sense, that's right. There are about 120 gigawatts in total outside of China. When I give that 12% figure of plants outside of China with Chinese financial participation, the absolute figure there was 120 gigawatts, right? So it's pretty comparable to what already exists out there that China has invested in. Of that, 20% has been canceled, but there's still 80 gigawatts of potential, up to 80 gigawatts of potential additions in the pipeline. Again, I think that a lot of these projects could be canceled. And I think we should expect that given the current environment and given the trends that we've seen during the 2010s. You know, even if a third of those go ahead, that's a significant amount of added coal. And so I think that the work to be done on pushing for reconceptualization is still very important.
The flip side of that is, of course, new energy. And China is producing more. I think it's becoming a driving part of its economic activity and growth. Do you think we're going to see more outbound investment in renewables? Is there a financial model also around those? Because the BRI has also been associated with debt traps or sort of Chinese financing that have indebted countries. Does the financing model also change under potentially more exports of clean energy?
That's a very good question. I think certainly we will see clean energy taking a larger role as a share of investments. I do think at the same time, the overall volume is not going to get back to what it was of any investments outbound, not going to get back to what it was in the mid-2010s. And that reflects that shift from volume to quality, which should also have an impact on what those debt loads look like in host countries. You know, I think there's a tension here in that we need an enormous amount of investment for the developing world in clean energy, and that is a very capital intensive thing to do. And so there's a big picture question from a global financial architecture's perspective of how do you direct capital to the developing world for the clean transition in a way where those debts are absorbable. That's not a China-specific question. That is a global question. I do think China's share in that funding flow, their appetite for participating in that funding flow is weaker than it was, or for dominating that funding flow is weaker than it was 5 or 10 years ago because of their experience with the riskiness of operating in some of these emerging markets. Still, within the share of what China's doing outbound, we're going to see more clean stuff. 56% of energy investment contracting in the first half of 2023 out of China outbound went to renewable energy. 56% of a smaller number is still a smaller number.
And I guess there's a question of whether we incorporate some of those minerals and materials. So investments in those minerals and materials, they don't count as clean energy per se, right? Because we're looking at renewables, but the data will presumably change if we look at those. But if we, and I know that we're kind of coming to the end of our time, if we try and take a bit of a look forward and also think about, you were talking about the global financing architecture and the financing that's available, we're seeing an economic slowdown in China. What does that mean for China's ability to invest along the BRI? There's also been some talk about China sort of shifting its focus away from the BRI, instead promoting other initiatives like the Global Development Initiative, the Global Security Initiative. So how do we think about the future of the Belt and Road? I know this is a massive question, but give us your thoughts on, again, the coming 10 years for the Belt and Road Initiative.
The Belt and Road Initiative over the next 10 years is no longer the only sort of thing in terms of large Chinese outbound diplomatic efforts that attracts folks' attention. It's part of a broader ecosystem, a broader diplomatic portfolio that's covering not just physical infrastructure, like at the core of the Belt and Road, but also a broader vision of a different world of global governance, building together anti-Western blocs like through the BRICS, promoting, you know, different approaches to human rights, some of these core aspects of the liberal international order, not all of them, but some of them, and a mix of outbound engagement that looks may look a little bit more like what we've seen from multilateral development banks and from Western players in terms of a larger place for traditional, the kinds of development aid, say grant-based activities around that can help with soft power or kind of software for development, so to speak, that have become a real staple of the World Bank and of your Western development agencies. So the BRI will be one piece of this broader diplomatic portfolio. Within the BRI, I think the really interesting question that I want to follow is, what does that composition of investments look like on a sectoral basis? And I think an important factor here to think about is that there are going to be different pressures to seek out export markets across different sectors. What is growing in China? What is shrinking in China? Growing is renewable energy. Renewable energy is growing massively. There's so many opportunities for capturing market within China. You don't necessarily need to go abroad to find growth. If you're in the cement sector, I've seen folks from the China Cement Association project a 60% decline in capacity in the cement sector between today and 2036. That's 13 years and retirements of more than a billion tons of cement capacity. If you're looking for a market, China is not your place. You got to go abroad. You got to go to the developing world because that's where cement growth happens. 90% of cement demand is in the developing world. It's places that are building things. So I think that some of these, there's going to be a spectrum of companies that have been part of China's traditional development model at home that face different pressures for finding new kinds of markets. And I think that ones that are shrinking are likely going to be more enthusiastic about going abroad.
Ned, thank you so much for that really insightful overview and discussion. We are, I'm afraid, out of time, but since you've said that you were going to be following a few other elements of the BRI, that gives us scope for additional check-ins and chats in the future. But really, thank you very much for joining me today. Thank you to our audience for listening. If you are interested in the Guide to Chinese Climate Policy, it is available on the OIES website. You can download it there. You can also purchase a hardback copy on Amazon. But I hope you will tune in to additional podcasts. They can all be found alongside our research on the OIES website.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.